Welcome to the Sleep Junkies podcast. My name is Jeff Mann, and I'm the founder and editor of sleepjunkies.com. And we cover the whole conversation on sleep. And today we're going to talk about a subject we've not covered before. We're going to talk about dreams, specifically the science of dreaming. Now, just as sleep science is a relatively young discipline, the science of dreaming is still very much in its early days as well. And so some of the fundamental questions, such as why do we dream? What do dreams mean? Do dreams actually serve any purpose at all? There are many, many competing theories and lots of interesting work and research going on all around the world. So today what we're going to do, we're just going to take a high level look at the history of dream research. And we're going to talk to one of the world's leading authorities in this field. But if you're interested in dreams and specifically the scientific inquiry into what dreams are, what is the function of dreams, what does dream content mean, then I think you'll find this really interesting. So that's it for the introduction. If you're liking the podcast, don't forget to subscribe. Check us out on social media, Instagram. We've got a Facebook group, Sleep Junkies Worldwide, Twitter, and on the website, sleepjunkies.com. Okay, on with the show.
Good afternoon. I'm joined here today with Dr. Antonio Zadra.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Just as a bit of background, you lead a laboratory at the University of Montreal in Canada. When was the laboratory set up?
Back in the late 1990s. So there's actually two labs. There's one dedicated to the study of dreams. I'm also affiliated with a center for the study of sleep and sleep disorders, where I also do more psychophysiological and brain imaging research on what are known as parasomnias, unwanted behaviors during sleep, things like sleep terrors, nightmares, and especially sleepwalking.
There's an interesting story, isn't there, about how you got into the field. You had a lucid dream.
Yes, when I was in college, I had a lucid dream, though I didn't know what it was called at the time. It was really long, convoluted, a bit nightmarish in some sections where I got stabbed. I was in a jail. I escaped. I was pursued. I got into these big snowball fights. Anyways, it was very exceedingly vivid. And at one point, I became aware that I was dreaming, was aware that I was probably in my bedroom on my back sleeping. I lie down on my stomach in the dream. I yelled, knowing that I was making no noise in my actual bedroom. Anyways, this is the first dream when I woke up from this, the first dream really that I ever wrote down. And perchance, a little while afterwards, came across this wonderful little book called Creative Dreaming by Patricia Garfield. And in this book was a chapter on what are called lucid dreams. And so I went, wow, okay, there's a name for the kind of dream that I had. And not only that, but it has a pretty rich history. And at the time were also the first studies coming out of Stanford University by Stephen LaBerge on studying lucid dreams in the sleep lab. And so this really got me interested in reading more about dreams, lucid dreaming in particular, and on how people were doing research on dreams. So I got into this really because of a dream I had. Otherwise, I probably would have followed the footsteps of my older brother and gone to medical school, which was my original plan.
That's a fascinating point. It was a dream in the first place that led you into this area. Yeah, just a bit more background about the lab. And you have a team of researchers there. Can you just give us a brief overview about the type of work that you're doing into dreams in particular?
Sure. So our two main points of interest of our work, I would say, is one is trying to quantify what people dream about. So what is the content of people's dreams? And this is of interest for everyday dreams. So what are the settings? Who are the characters? The nature of the social interactions? And then seeing how these patterns that we observe over long series of people's dreams relate to past experiences, their psychological well-being, differences between men and women. We studied the dreams of schizophrenics, depressed individuals, people with a history of trauma. And we're also interested in the content of specific kinds of dreams, such as nightmares, for instance, recurrent dreams, sex dreams, and finding out why do they occur, what are their frequencies, what are their thematic contents, and again, in which ways do the contents of our dreams reflect ongoing concerns, past personal histories. So in an attempt really to figure out in which ways the dreams that we have are not just random products of the brain, but how they relate to our waking experiences, thoughts, and ongoing emotional concerns. We also, as I was saying earlier, part of our research is dedicated to better understanding the pathophysiology of some sleep disorders, such as sleepwalking. I'm also fascinated in the phenomenology of sleepwalking, that is, what do sleepwalkers recall of their episodes, and how does this sleep mentation relate to the behaviors we observe? And here we're doing studies that vary from genetics to brain imaging to more standard EEG studies of what's going on in these people's brains before and during their episodes that we sometimes record in the sleep laboratory.
Can I just ask a bit of a broad question? A lot of people have this idea that dreams come from somewhere else. Some people think it's random noise in the brain, or some people relate it to religious experience. How do you kind of respond when people come with those views about you actually doing a real scientific inquiry into the experience of dreaming?
Well, the first thing is that when most people, when they think about dreams, what comes to mind is dream interpretation. And so their view of the kind of work people interested by dreams do is, well, what do they mean? What are the symbols? And so they are generally unaware of how dreams can be systematically studied in the sleep laboratory across different sleep stages. Then we actually know a fair bit about what's going on in the brain when people dream, factors that influence why we recall our dreams, when we recall them, and that we know a lot about the content of people's dreams from childhood to old age, and that there's compelling evidence that far from being random creations of the brain, dreams show developmental patterns, show gender differences, show differential relations across different portions of society. And that maybe above all, dreams are really fairly transparent reflections of emotionally salient experiences and concerns that people have in their waking lives.
Okay, I like that. Transparent reflections. It's a nice term to frame the idea of this mystery of dreaming. I've already veered off the agenda here, what we're going to talk about. This isn't actually on the list, but we've discussed it. So I want to go back to the ancients, the Greeks, and possibly you may be able to talk about it even before that. But we just want to talk about earliest conceptions of what our understanding of dreams were. And my sort of layman's view of this is that dreams were messages from the gods.
That sums it up quite well, that either the dreams were messages of the gods, or that dreams were real parallel worlds, if you want, that the spirit or soul of a person visited during sleep, so that the images, the places that we see, the people with whom we interact in our dreams actually have some sort of reality. So the idea that the dreams are created internally by the brain and that we are immersed in this sort of hallucinatory virtual world, but that is of our own creation, is really something relatively recent in our conceptualizations of dreams. And incidentally, I'd like to point out, is also something that we learn as children. The reason most kids will go wake up their parents after having a nightmare is because they are afraid that the monster is still under their bed or in their closet. So they believe that even once they wake up, characters that were chasing dangers present in their dreams are still there in their sleep environment, in their bedroom. They also often believe that other people can observe their dreams as they are sleeping. So the idea that dreams is a subject, private experience, is a really tricky concept and one that we only gradually come to learn as a function of what our parents, friends, and peers tell us as we grow up and as we occasionally share our most memorable dreams with them.
Okay. So, at the height of Greek civilization, Greek philosophy, what was the conception of dreams back at that time? What are the general perceived ideas about why we dreamt?
Well, I think the two most important ideas that were articulated was, one, that dreams could result from bodily processes. And so, without mentioning the brain, that areas of the body were responsible for creating dreams. And so the source of dreams were not these external agents, be they gods or parallel worlds, but that they emanated ultimately from within the dreamer. The other important question put forth was, to what extent are we responsible for the contents of our dreams? So if we have aggressive impulses, if we have inappropriate sexual dreams, and questions of morality and responsibility, which really touches to the sources, memory sources or others of where the content of our dreams come from. So already at the time, we're having a different conceptualization of where dreams come from, what are their ultimate sources. And so there's this interplay between there are messages from the gods. So the gods don't speak equally to the kings and to peasants, and that dreams really have a much more mundane source, but which always lies within the dreamer. And this is the current that will continue really into the 17th, 18th century, where people are trying to address the questions of the sources of dreams, right until really Freud's influence and legacy with respect to why we dream.
So really, in that whole time, there were no interim ideas. This legacy stayed with us for a long time until Freud came along.
Well, there were probably hundreds of ideas, but there were really variants over these two basic dueling conceptions about dreams come from external sources or are internally generated. And because we knew and still know very little about gods and how they communicate with us and what parallel worlds might be like, and we know very little about how bodily processes might give rise to these rich hallucinatory experiences, a lot of it was really speculative ideas. And so I wouldn't say there was nothing. There was actually a lot, but they're all variants on these basic ideas.
Can you just encapsulate for our listeners Freud's initial explorations into this area, eventually becoming a seminal work on the what he attempted to do, a scientific understanding of dreaming? And also, we want to bring into the mix one of his contemporaries, Jung, as well, and how these two figures made such a big impact into our current understanding of dreams, where we are now.
Well, first, maybe the most important thing I like to clarify with regards to Freud is that many of his ideas were not as original as he made them out to be. So when we ask students, friends, or people what marked the scientific study of dreams, most will say that it was Freud, or sometimes they'll say the discovery of REM sleep. But the idea that dreams arise from the unconscious, that they might be about sexual thoughts related to repressed wishes, that they're symbolic, that they can be interpreted, almost all of these ideas were articulated well before the interpretation of dreams. And secondly, we now know that Freud really exaggerated inconsistencies between authors that preceded him, diminished the importance that other people were giving to psychological factors implicated in dreams, and he presented himself as the founder of psychological as opposed to medical or bodily study of dreams. And this is really a misleading claim. There are really many authors that preceded Freud with, when we examine their work today, it is really their work which is most closely tied to modern scientific and neuroscientific research on dreams. And so Freud, in his Interpretation of Dreams, concludes that the scientific understanding of dreams has made very little advance. And this is really an unfair, biased, and ultimately self-serving assessment of this large body of work. And so I can just give you a few examples. There's an English psychologist, James Sully, who wrote a lot about the origins, interpretations of dreams. He's one of the first people who talked about wish fulfillment, the desires we repress in wakefulness and how they get expressed in dreams, the primal instinctive impulses that arise from the subconscious and how that emanates in dreams. And Freud didn't acknowledge any of his work till about 20 years after the first edition of The Interpretation of Dreams, even though he had clearly read it. And there's many others. If I start telling you about the penis could be symbolized by a tobacco, a pipe, by a knife, or a clarinet, people will say, oh, yes, that's Freud. No, that was someone else. That's Carl Scherner, which Freud, again, only cited much later. But these ideas were there much before. Some of his key concepts with respect to how dreams were formed really come from someone else, Hervé Saint-Denis, which many people might be familiar with the studies on lucid dreaming. But he put forth how images can come to represent various ideas within the dream. So how we confuse characters, something he called abstractions or the superimposition of images. And this really will become the concepts of displacement and condensation in Freud's model. Other people, Alfred Murray, talked about differences in brain function between dreaming brain and the waking brain, tried to explain bizarre, incoherent elements in dreams, wrote about the memory sources of dreams, how sensory stimulations impact dreams. And so this was in the 1860s, and it's fascinating to note that after the discovery of REM sleep, some of the very first lab studies of dreams were exactly on the effects of external stimuli on participants' dreams, exactly what Alfred Murray was trying to do over 100 years before. And there's many other examples. Mary Whitton Calkins, which was a pioneering female psychologist at Wellesley College, was one of the first to use statistical principles to analyze the content of dream reports, a tradition that is now really omnipresent in the scientific study of dreams. She also tried to develop systematic questionnaires and other quantitative methods to try to understand how dreams are formed and how we can talk about a science of dreams. And finally, maybe someone else, a contemporary of Freud, which Freud qualified as someone who had nothing of interest to say, who wrote extensively about dream interpretation. His name was Sante de Sanctis. He studied sleep and dreaming in under controlled conditions, one of the first people to use electrophysiology to investigate dreams. He wrote about the interplay between sleep, dreams, and memory, which today is one of the most important and overriding research venues in the field, is how sleep and to a certain extent dreams play a role in how we consolidate our memories, how they evolve through brain structures. He also started proposing ways that the brain initiates dreams and how other areas of the brain are responsible for elaborating their contents. And so there's this wealth of other people other than Freud, deeply immersed in ideas about the clinical use of dreams, about their scientific study, which unfortunately over time became forgotten. And instead of giving credit to these pioneers of dream research, much of the focus, for many historical reasons, only came back to Freud. And even when you mention Jung, you know, the importance given to Freud as opposed to Jung, they had very different conceptualizations of dreams. But Freud really occupied the overwhelming space for over 100 years when it came to dreams. And since you mentioned Jung, I would just say that whereas Freud saw dreams as basically a pathological process that tried to hide their true nature from the dreamer, Jung was much more open to the idea that dreams were something healthy, constructive, creative, and that although they might necessitate interpretation because they are often metaphorical or based in plot structures that have find their history in fairy tales or archetypes and so on, he still thought they were essentially transparent messages, that the brain does its best to give our ideas, to give our concerns visual representations. And often the best way to do this is through the use of well-known story structures and metaphors, but that this was essentially something transparent and constructive as opposed to Freud's view. And so, unfortunately, like I said, many of these ideas, which are much closer to what people are studying and modern conceptualizations on the origins and function of dreams, can be traced to these people whose work preceded Freud or that arrived at the same time as Freud's ideas, but who, unfortunately, whose contributions were forgotten over decades and over the century.
Okay, so we've gone from the ancients to Freud and his contemporaries. Before we get to the 20th century, which is where we started to really understand what was going on in the brain and be able to peer inside the sleeping brain, we mentioned before this idea of symbolism. So we've got this whole concept of, you know, dreams as having symbolic meaning and dream dictionaries. You can go out and buy a dream dictionary and people will look them up and say, oh, I had a dream about what it was, a pink frog. And we had a little conversation before this and you brought up a very salient point that we don't really remember the vast proportion of our dreams. So this whole idea of a symbolic meaning to dreams, which Freud was very big on, it doesn't really make any sense if that is the function of dreams, to have a symbol. I wonder if that was a good point to slot into the conversation here, this idea of symbolism.
Right. Well, there's two intermixed points in your statement. One is, do dreams have these sort of universal symbols? And two, is the function of dreams somehow tied into their interpretation? So you mentioned the dream dictionaries, and what I often tell people is that, look, if you want to buy one of those dictionaries and have some fun with them, well, it's probably no harm done. However, the idea that the, you know, a pink frog means this, you know, a bear means this, and dreaming of losing your teeth means something else across everyone is really erroneous. Our dreams have multiple memory sources, and so I might dream that I am in my car with my wife and stuck in a snowbank. Now, I might be having that dream because earlier that day, I was stuck in a snowbank in my car, or I might have seen someone, or I thought about it as they announced a snowstorm. But it could also be that it's a terrific metaphor for the fact that I'm feeling that my relationship isn't going anywhere. And so the love as a journey metaphor is replayed by me being with my loved one in a car. And even though I'm pressing on the gas pedal and trying to make things go forward, we're not moving anywhere. And we could even add to that. If in my dream, my spouse asked me to get out of the car and try to push. It might represent the fact that I'm feeling like I'm the one who's doing all the work in trying to move their relationship forward. And so to tease all of this apart, what does it mean to be in a vehicle stuck? What does it mean to be flying in a dream? Really depends on what are our ongoing concerns. Is this a good metaphor for something? But it could also not at all be a metaphor. It could be related to something we saw or heard during the daytime, what are known since the time of Freud and even before him as day residues, these relatively mundane elements from waking life that get weaved into our dream narrative. So this is not to say that dreams don't necessarily have some sort of psychological meaning, but that they rarely carry these universal symbols, that the things an eagle in my dream and an eagle in your dream probably does not signify the same thing. We really need to look at the overall dream narrative and also at what we've experienced during the day and also what eagles in this particular example means to each one of us. I might say, oh, well, an eagle to me is a freedom, you know, because they soar through the air. And you can say, oh, no, you know, to me, eagle is someone who is a creature with fine perception because it can zero in on a mole at, you know, at many hundreds of yards away. And so each element of our dreams speaks to us as a function of our own conceptualizations of these elements and how they relate to our everyday lives. The second question is dream interpretation part of dream's function? And so we know that we dream across multiple sleep stages, not only REM sleep, but even if we just focus on the most vivid dreams recalled out of REM sleep, we know that we have at least 3 or 6 per night, whereas on average, people remember about 4 to 6 dreams a month. And so the overwhelming majority of our dreams are forgotten. And so whatever function dreams have, it is probably executed as they are occurring, regardless of whether or not you remember them. If that was not the case, then dreaming would be a colossal waste of time. Because most dreams are never remembered. And even the ones that we do remember, unless we tell them to someone else or write them down, the memory of them quickly evaporates upon awakening. And so any function tied to recalling them really disappears very quickly. And then you get, you know, these weird circumstances. What if you wake up and you don't remember a dream, and then later on in the day, you recall a dream fragment from the day before? Now, all of a sudden, 6 hours later, the dream that you had during the night acquires a function because now, in the middle of the afternoon, you recall a fraction of it. So none of this really makes sense. And then if we look, what proportion, if you think back, Jeff, the last 10, 20 dreams you might have had, how many of them did you have interpreted? And we can set aside the question of who interpreted, were they right, was it useful to you? But your answer will probably be 0 or maybe 1 or 2. So a small percentage of the dreams that we recall, which is already a small, infinitely small percentage of all the dreams we experience, get shared or interpreted with others. And so this is the distinction between the biological function of dreams, what they are doing that is adaptive for us as they are ongoing, and the uses we can make of them. So you recall a dream, and maybe you will, by discussing it, sharing it with others, you can use it to learn more about yourself. There's a very rich history about dreams, how they are used in the arts in terms of creativity, paintings, novels. So you can use dreams for many different sources, but these are uses that we make upon awakening that is adapted from one person to the next. And this is not necessarily the biological function of dreams, which also is probably present in children who rarely have their dreams interpreted incidentally. And there are people who go their entire lives without ever having shared a single dream or having had even one of their dreams interpreted. And clearly, dreams must be playing the same biological role in these individuals as those who choose to share them or to keep a dream diary or to use them for entertainment or self-discovery or creative outlets.
I love the way you spun that question about this function of dreams. And when we think about the tradition in the arts, and, you know, we talked about religion earlier, and then we talked about Jung and feeding into this idea of dreams as, you know, maybe collective experiences as well. That strikes me as an obvious function as well, a way of expressing the or sharing or discussing the human condition in ways that we're not consciously doing it, but we're still sharing some whatever it is, emotions, feelings, hopes.
Absolutely. And when we look at some common themes, sort of dreams of being chased or pursued, dreams of falling, dreams of driving, being in a vehicle out of control, all of these, or dreams of not being ready for an examination, which are quite common, all of these can be great metaphors for ongoing concerns or challenges that we have. Dreams of not being ready for an exam or failing an exam or realizing you never went to your courses, they tend to happen in periods of self-doubt, in periods where we have challenges that we may be are not sure we're ready to meet or that we will meet people's expectations. And so these are great ways to use our past experiences to encapsulate or embody these concerns. And some of these are quite universal, these overarching themes. Now, who is chasing you? Why? Where you are? Who else is present? Does he end up catching you? How do you flee? Do you wake up from this? All this will vary from one dream to another and from one person to another. But the overarching theme that some people might want to tie into Jung's ideas of archetypes or Jung's ideas of the collective unconscious, I agree, is absolutely fascinating and of great interest, both empirically and clinically.
Great. Let's move on to the 20th century. So in the middle of the 20th century, we made some discoveries, and some people say it's the beginning of modern sleep science. There was a study in the 1950s where, for the first time, we discovered REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, where the majority of dreams occur. But could you just say a few words about how these discoveries influenced our understanding of dreaming and the directions it took from there?
Certainly. Well, the discovery by Eugene Ossorinsky of rapid eye movement sleep in a series of papers in the early 1950s were really revolutionary. We discovered a stage whereby, as the name suggests, not only do our eyes move rapidly in bursts back and forth, and we can see these movements under our closed eyelids, but when people then looked at what else was going on in these individuals, they saw that their EEG, the electrical signals picked up by electrodes placed on the scalp, were very similar to one we could observe during wakefulness. So the brain, even though the person is asleep, is acting as if it was awake. And paradoxically, we also discovered that these people were actively paralyzed. There's this thing called sleep atonia or muscle paralysis that accompanies rapid eye movement sleep. And when we wake up people from this stage of sleep, in 89% of the cases, people will recall a dream. So all of a sudden, there was a biology of dreaming. We had an idea of when people were dreaming, and so we could start systematically studying what's going on in the brain? What's going on in the body while people are dreaming? What happens if we wake them up after bursts of eye movements or when their heart rate accelerates? What are they dreaming about? Do dreams change as a function of different sleep stages during the night? And so it opened up really a whole new sphere of research into dreams, again, more under underlying biology. Unfortunately, it also led to many theories of dreams where dreams are equivalent to REM sleep. And so whatever function people ended up finding for REM sleep became the function of dreams. So a study on the effects of REM sleep deprivation would become reported as, well, the dream-deprived brain. Or if a study found that the loss of REM sleep in rats resulted in hypothermia, it became, well, dreaming may help keep the brain warm. And we still see these things today, especially in the media. For instance, last year there was a study in mice that found there was these two genes that were necessary for REM sleep. So instead of saying that mouse REM sleep depends on these two genes, the headline scene where your dreams come from two genes, or maybe removing genes that code for dreams may allow scientists to stop nightmares.
So this quest for the dream gene.
Yes, but it's a gene for REM sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
And REM sleep is a physiological state. Dreams is a subjective experience we have during our sleep. It's this virtual world that we are immersed in. And it is not at all clear that mice have dreams in the same sense that humans do. And so confounding dreams with REM sleep, and we also know that dreams occur in other stages of sleep, it has also hurt the research because, as I said, REM sleep is a physiologically defined sleep stage, and dreaming is the subjective experience that people have while sleeping. And when we want to know what is the function of dreams, we want to know it's the fact that we have these subjective experiences. We are immersed in these virtual worlds where we meet people, interact with them, experience fear, shame, guilt, sexual arousal. Does this have a function independently of what's going on physiologically in our brains and in our bodies? Because REM sleep could occur without any of the subjective experience, and probably does in some species.
Okay, so I like this idea, the 1950s, we now have a biology of dreaming. Would you be able, it's probably a very hard question to answer, maybe some of the big ideas, the major modern scientific theories of, we'll just talk about the function dreams.
Sure.
I don't know if that's too big of a question to, if you're able to break it down for our listeners.
Oh, I think I can break it down pretty succinctly. So as I was just mentioning earlier, there's the idea that whatever function of dreams may have is intimately tied to the function of REM sleep. And that dreams maybe in and of themselves don't have a function, but they're reflecting what's going on in REM sleep. The problem with this is that we also know that dreams occur at sleep onset and stage two sleep, so they're not uniquely tied to REM sleep. There's the idea that dreams help us solve problems, and there's many wonderful anecdotes of inventions and discoveries, music compositions, and so on, that have been inspired by dreams. But probably many of these more celebrated examples probably highlight the rarity of such events. You know, there's probably billions of dreams being dreamt worldwide every night, and very few of them are giving rise to really new inventions or solving problems. Also, when we solve problems, it's often because after awakening from the dream, and upon thinking about it, a solution comes to us. The solution is rarely present in the dream itself. But even this occurs, it's such a minority of dreams that solve concretely problems that that's probably not its function, but it's one idea. There's also evolutionary-based functions of dreams. So one of the better known is the threat simulation function of dreams, which basically says that dreams evolved in our ancestors to help us rehearse threats that would put us in peril, and also to rehearse appropriate responses to them. So dreams would have evolved to help us adapt and prepare and react to various threats that our ancestors had to face, and it's probably why, in the context of this model, dreams tend to be more negative than positive, and why themes such as being chased, pursued, physically attacked, or attacked by animals, still occur in people's dreams, even though in waking life, very few of us are actively chased during the day or attacked by wild animals and things of that sort. Another variation of these evolutionary theories suggests that maybe dreams evolved to simulate social interactions. Most dreams have the dreamer, but also other dream characters with whom we interact. And so maybe dreams evolved and continue to serve the function of simulating social interactions, which are important both for the individual and the individual's role within society. A more clinically based view of dream function is that dreams help us regulate our emotions. We know that REM sleep probably plays a role in regulating emotions, and there is also some evidence that what we dream about, especially when we are intensely preoccupied by something or when we are living through emotionally salient experiences, that the content of our dreams helps us regulate our emotions to integrate these experiences into broader networks. And then, of course, there's people who believe that dreams hold a great deal of psychologically meaningful information, but that they have no biological function in and of themselves. So they're sort of spandrels. And so these are probably currently some of the more frequently put forth models of why we dream. And there's also increasing evidence that dreams probably play an important role within sleep in how our memories are consolidated and how memory evolution in sleep occurs, how memories get stored and attached to other similar networks, semantically related networks in our sleep, and that dreams may also be actively playing a role in these biological functions that we are understanding more and more about as they pertain to sleep. And there's really wonderful work also being done in terms of brain imaging, which is opening new venues of understanding of maybe where dreams come from and the possible function that they may serve.
That's a really good overview of the current leading theories. Just one question on that. So a lot of these themes of broad themes of the function of dreams that you described, in a lot of ways, is how people describe the function of sleep in its broadest sense, you know, regulating our emotions, consolidating memories. So I'm wondering where that line can be drawn. If we say, is this the dreams themselves, or is it the function, the biological functions of what sleep is? Does that make sense, that question?
Yes, absolutely. I think that part of that answer comes to what dreams are, and dreams are these often emotionally engaging, narratively driven, subjective experiences. And to the extent that that is true, then there must be an added value of having these subjective experiences that add to whatever the brain is computing during sleep. And because the brain could be doing, executing lots of these tasks without us having these experiences of dreams. So having these subjective experiences, whether we recall them later or not, probably adds something to what sleep is already doing. So either makes it more effective, allows it to store better, reactivates these semantic networks or memory networks, or forms these associations in a much more effective and compelling way than the sleeping brain could if it was deprived from these subjective experiences that we have that we call dreams. But the two clearly are intimately tied, since dreams, of course, occur during sleep, including at sleep onset.
spandrel is some sort of evolutionary byproduct that serves no functional purpose.
Yeah, sort of like an epiphenomenon.
Can we pretty much dismiss an argument if somebody comes to us and say dreams are just complete nonsense? Have we got to the point where we can just say, no, actually, they're not nonsense?
Well, I think there's really compelling evidence that dreams show distinct patterns, that they are related to emotional concerns, as I said, to really concrete experiences that we have had. So dreams are random is in itself nonsense. Dreams do show these elaborate, well documented in really probably hundreds of studies, relations to waking life. The question really becomes, does any of this really have a biological function? So even some dream theorists like Bill Domhoff, who's from the University of California, Santa Cruz, who's dedicated his entire life to showing how dreams are psychologically meaningful, believes that dreams in and of itself don't have a biological function. And so are dreams random? Absolutely not. Do they have a function that a minority of people will say no, even though they are meaningful, they don't have a function in and of themselves? And others will say yes, and that function might be tied to emotional regulation, memory processing, creativity, who knows? So the jury is still out, or there's no consensus regarding the function of dreams. But I would say that more and more people are starting to believe that they certainly do, and that there is growing evidence and research pointing to what the biological, evolutionary-based function of dreams might be, independently of what is going on during sleep.
Okay. I just wondered if you could take a couple of minutes, maybe give the listeners a little picture of an inkling of what the future of this field might be. I've seen some headlines in the past of people talking about a future where we may be able to do things like they do in Inception, the movie.
Right.
Maybe just give our listeners a little inkling of where this might go. This area is a fascinating area of research.
Well, certainly. There's really these very powerful research tools at our disposal, whether we talk about brain imaging tools, high-density EEG recordings, algorithms based on deep learning, machine learning. So we have these tools that are used in different venues of research, especially in the neurosciences, which are increasingly used to study not only sleep, but dreaming within sleep. And I think much of the future breakthroughs with respect to the field of dream research are going to come from these technologies. Now, people might overestimate what is possible. So for instance, we often talk about, oh, we'll be able to see what people are dreaming about. But to the extent that we can't do that with someone who is awake and imagining something by examining what's going on in the brain, it's probably even harder to do with someone who is asleep and dreaming of something. But we're getting closer to identifying brain areas that seem to be active when we are dreaming, the neural correlates of dream recall, what's going on in the brain that makes it that such that some people will recall a dream versus forget it. Why are some dreams emotional or visually salient? So we're learning much more about the structure of dreams, the process that give rise to them. And now there's also on the more psychological front, really much more sophisticated studies that are addressing the question of why do we dream about the things that we dream about? How do our dreams relate to the events of our waking lives? And trying to parse out emotionally salient events versus stressful events versus mundane events, events from the day prior to the dream, the week prior, or from years ago. And so we're getting a better picture of how these various factors come into play in determining what we dream about on a nightly basis, and on the biological side, understanding how the brain goes about constructing these images that we have. And you briefly mentioned lucid dreaming, which for me is what got me interested in this and that I find absolutely fascinating. But the study of lucid dreaming in the laboratory and of techniques for inducing lucid dreams, I think also holds a really promising venue to us understanding the whys and how we dream.
Yeah, absolutely. I know there's a lot of research going on into lucid dreaming as well. Where can people find out more about your work? You have a website, the Zadra Lab.
Yes, there's a website which is basically just my name, antonio.zadra.com, where they can find what projects are ongoing or publications. Some news also about both fiction and nonfiction works based on dreams that I'm involved with, and where they can also reach me with questions or comments.
Fantastic. And you're on social media as well, aren't you? You're on Twitter, I believe.
Yes, correct. Dr. Z Dreams.
And we briefly mentioned your book, which I'm looking forward to. It's out next year with what one of the pioneers in this research, Dr. Stickold.
Absolutely. And one of the many wonderful things about this collaboration is that we come from very different backgrounds, have very different conceptualizations of dreams, ways of approaching dream research. And so we bring to this very complementary ideas and arrive at many compromises along the way of trying to portray the most accurate picture possible about why we dream, what they mean, how we can use them, as well as, you know, more of their history and where dream research might be going moving forth.
Thanks so much, Dr. Zadra.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
You've been listening to the Sleep Junkies podcast. If you like this episode, then don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review, and you can follow us on social media on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and on the website sleepjunkies.com. See you on the next episode.